content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we left off last time when we are in the chapter on youth, which is May and June. And the topic was mulch wisdom. Plants are the mulch. Landscape architect Claudia West reminds us lately. Her message boasts aesthetic and environmental, and I discuss such ground covers elsewhere in the book. The kind you shovel on or dump from a wheelbarrow, then spread, isn't meant as decor, and that's the unsaid part of what Claudia implies. We aren't going about the hard work of gardening to show off big swatches of mulch, but rather well-grown plants. However, the right mulch material used well serves several purposes and is critical in new beds where the living mulch, the plants, hasn't knitted together yet. In establishing beds, the kind of mulch I use also serves as a sort of passive soil amending regime. More on that below. I create another great woman of gardening from another era for instilling my faith in mulch. God invented mulching, wrote Ruth Stout, who followed her 1955 book, How to Have a Green Thumb Without an Aching Back, a new method of mulch gardening. With the equally offbeat early 60s classic, Gardening Without Work. She promised freedom from weeds and optimum soil health to gardeners who piled on 8 inches of hay mulch and not a blade less. Stout's idea were repackaged in 1971 as Ruth Stout's No Work Garden Book, and some version has been variously repackaged since. Long before phrases like lasagna garden were making the grounds of the as-yet uninvented internet, Stout, sometimes gardening in the buff, was layering all her organic materials on top of the soil, sheet composting, as it might be traditionally called, more the stuff of homesteaders than backyard types. Her tactics serve to suppress weeds, reduce fertilizer use, conserve moisture, and spare her the work of composting in a conventional heap with all the toting and turning. Her foundational principle was applying mulch, mulch, and more mulch, and then simply moving it back a smidge each year to make room for each row of seeds. No till, no weeds. She said the aha moment came one spring when the plowman hadn't come yet to till, and she was eager to get planting. She saw that the asparagus, a long-lived perennial, was already up, poking through the fallen leaves. So she walked over to the plant and asked it why she had to plow over the other vegetables, if not it. Apparently, the asparagus answered that she didn't. Mulch also keeps root zones cool. It fosters abundant soil life from microbes to earthworms, and it improves soil texture as the mulch breaks down. Raindrops, not just footsteps, can compact soil, which mulch can buffer, and it can help prevent the crusting over of bare soil that causes moisture to run off. Using the wrong kind of mulch or the right one at the wrong time can defeat the purpose. If I mulch too early, I might smother would-be volunteers or self-sowns. Mulching too thickly, especially around tree trunks and shrubs, often called volcano mulching, is bad for trees. Bark won't evolve to live in the dark and damp. Never put mulch right up against the trunks of woody plants. What makes good mulch? This can be confusing, since what's sold as mulch in many cases isn't suitable for the full range of duties. I seek a material that is an organic substance, meaning deriving from some living or formerly living matter, fine to medium textured, so it will break down into the underlying soil, but substantial enough to stay put. Preferably aged before I use it, dark in color like soil is, if for the ornamental beds, available locally at a good price, preferably in bulk delivery unbagged, and not a source of contaminants, pests, or diseases. In ornamental beds, I use fine to medium textured, dark colored mulch, never anything that's going to sit there without breaking down, like big bark hunks, which I call baked potato mulch, because they are as big as spuds, or anything orange or black or otherwise dyed. Also, avoid very fine textured materials like sawdust that cake, blow around, and fail to decompose. Using a product that has been aged or composted means the mulch is ready to do its job as a soil improver. I can dig with my hands in all my beds where I have let this passive composting, in effect, happened by topping up the mulch over the years. So could stout. Years ago, I used bagged mulches, but switched to local materials delivered in bulk, sewn plastic bags, and minus the fuel used to truck it to my local garden center. My preferred mulch is a composted stable bedding, a local agricultural byproduct from horse or dairy farms. It's wood shavings, not too fine and not too coarse, that farmers spread on the floors of animal stalls to absorb manure and urine, and then muck out, age at a high enough temperature to destroy pathogens, and recycle into mulch. Leaf mold, partially rotted, shredded leaves, would also be great if your local landfill offers it, or start a leaves-only compost heap, pre-chopping with a shredder or mulching mower. I use all my homemade leaf compost on vegetables, in rough areas along the roadside or the paths between the raised beds. I use wood chips the power company or local arborist may share from a fallen tree or the occasional bag of nugget-sized bark chips. Sometimes, when prepping a new area or rehabbing one that's weedy, an organic mulch alone may not suffice to keep troubles at bay until the desired plants fill in. An underlayment of thick layers of black and white newsprint or a sheet of brown corrugated cardboard may add the extra oomph. And our next topic is growing potatoes. An organic potato farmer moved to my little town not long ago, and I count him and his family as friends, meaning I can just buy a few bagfuls to eat, though I'm not a restaurant or other wholesale customer. What I miss out on is the annual treasure hunt of wriggling my hand in from the side of the straw and soil hills I'd gradually formed on each of my own homegrown rows, looking for those first new potatoes, a prize equal to the first ripe tomato. Potato planting preparations really start in the fall, since with any early sown crop, I want to the soil ready. During October cleanup, I top up my raised beds with compost, enriching the loose, deep soil that is ideal for potatoes. They will adapt to other soil types, but the more organic matter, the better. If you use manure, make sure it's very well rotted and aged, or you invite the bacterial disease called scab, that pitting or raised corky surface patches on the potatoes that don't render the harvest inedible, but aren't very inviting. What often arrives in the bag of organic seed potatoes is a range of sizes. Many gardeners cut up the large ones into pieces that each have at least two eyes, letting the pieces sit overnight in a humid place to callus before planting. I never bothered to cut up my potatoes, which probably lowers the yield a bit, but may afford some protection from soil pests, including wireworms, which like the open flesh. No earlier than 2 to 3 weeks before my average last frost date, once the soil has begun to warm and drain, I dig a shallow trench about 6 to 8 inches deep with a hoe and space the seed potatoes 10 to 12 inches apart in the trench. A little farther with the large starts I didn't cut up, a little closer for fingerlings. I make one trench down the middle of my raised bed, but if you are doing multiple parallel rows in the ground, leave at least 3 feet between them, or more for easy access during hilling and harvest. I cover the tubers with about 3 to 4 inches of soil, so they are still in a shallow trench. Then, once the plants are up about 8 to 10 inches high, it's time to do the first hilling. Carefully bring the soil up around the vines from both sides with a rake or hoe until just the top leaves are above soil level. A couple of weeks later, I hill again, bringing another several inches of soil up around the vines. Though the second hilling could be a straw mulch instead, I think I get the best results with 2 soil hillings followed by straw or rotted leaf mulch. Assuming you choose a variety that is good immature, like one of the waxier fleshed varieties, new potatoes should be formed several weeks after the plant's flower. The signal that the main harvest is near is later, when the vines start to fade. Don't worry if they're in the ground through a couple of light frosts, but not hard freezes. A few years ago, I actually figured out the right storage spot at my house and finally had my own potatoes right into spring. A closet in my mudroom was as close as I could come to their desired high humidity combined with dark and cold, ideally 40 degrees Fahrenheit, but ranging from 38 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit. First, I cured them in a just slightly warmer place in baskets or trays, unwashed, just as they come from the ground, with heavy soil clods brushed gently off in a dark spot that was counterintuitively humid, like 90%, and between 50 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit. I got resourceful here and turned off the dehumidifier in my very primitive Victorian-era basement. This treatment lasts for 2 weeks, and then they go colder for storage. And that's the end of that chapter. So we're going to go into the next chapter, which is adulthood, which is July and August. And we start with a little write-up from our author first, and a little insight into her behavior. Throwing in the trowel is the topic of this little write-up. I give up. Enough is enough. I've had it. These are the kinds of phrases, tired but true, on my mind by sundown each of these days, when latest spring has slipped into the reality of summer, after 8 or 10 hours spent trying to solve the puzzle I started in the dirt some years ago. Where do all the plants go to make a pretty garden? I wonder. Close to tears, surrounded by pots and pots of this and that. At the nursery, I had been certain I had to have all of them. But now, in their company, I am feeling kind of lost. What goes next to what? How many of these and how many of those will make a picture perfect? And why did I put that there? What was I thinking? Oh, why didn't I draw a plan the way I tell others to do and then stick to it? If only it were a jigsaw puzzle of cut-up cardboard pieces and there was in each plant a clue, an interlocking edge, or some other clever device that fit it into place and let you know you've got it right. But that is not how it is, as anyone who has tried this business of designing even a single flower bed will certainly confirm. The purple asters look good with the purple-leaved heuchera, and the allium is good spiking up through the artemisia, but those were merely good guesses. There are plenty of bad guesses around the place, too. No wonder so much of gardening is accomplished on one's knees. My love-hate of garden-making has been running perilously close to the dark side lately as I desperately dug and dug some more, determined to find the answer. But then came early June, and not so early June, and I was still out there searching for the right arrangement. If I moved the smoke bush one more time, or that poor peripatetic pulmonaria, I would surely self-destruct. A weekend or two ago, I felt certain I could dig no more. If only I could plant everything in alphabetical rows instead of trying to make it look good, I'd be off the hook, I whined to a friend. There is no hook, the wiser gardener replied. Performing horticultural phone therapy, you created the hook. That sounded very clever and quite important, so I filed the remark carefully in my head. I wish he had told me where to put the damn Dutchman's breeches or the buckeye tree still sitting in a pot, but he did not. His garden is a showplace. He must know what he's talking about, I figured. But I did not really understand his words until the following weekend back in the dirt. I found myself feeling stressed and panicky, starting 10 tasks and finishing none, fixating on any holes in the puzzle all over again. Then I was overcome by a wild, freeing thought. How liberating it would be to borrow the neighbor's tractor and mow the whole place to stubble. If there had been a helpline for suicidal gardeners, I would have called it. Oh, if only for a 12-step meeting of Gardeners Anonymous. Yes, the hook is my doing, and I had hung myself on it by my nasty habit of only seeing the problems, the weak spots, the areas in need of more tinkering. Perfectionism and the task of starting a garden do not mix. I learned just at that moment, my half-empty mentality gave no gold stars for what had been accomplished, only demerits for what had not. Something would have to change. If I created the hook, then it is my prerogative to unhook myself, yes? I am therefore declaring this throw-in-the-trowel week, a horticultural holiday. I heartily recommend that any other gardened-out souls adopt in their localities, too. Admit it, spring is not just aging, it is past. So I say enough and quickly set about to fill in any really embarrassing bare spots with annuals or even pumpkin vines where my puzzle's weaknesses were on a grander scale. An even layer of mulch can work miracles in uniting plants that are far from knit together, too, and a cleanly cut edge around the bed makes things look almost bearable. After these last touches, only maintenance will be allowed till fall, when planting, hopefully without the panic, may be permitted once again. Conveniently, it is especially good timing for such a declaration. The first official day of summer and the onset of consistently hot weather, hard on transplants and transplanters, have been marked. Time to plug in the last babies and crawl into the hammock with a glass of tea. Time to give it, the seedlings, the soil, the soul, a rest. From this freshly liberated perspective, I think back upon my panic as if it were years in the past. All I seem to be doing is moving the same things around. I recall saying to the same wise friend, "Well, then, you're learning the secrets," he said, "ever inscrutable." And so I'll swing a while and think of what I'll be able to move to where when the time comes, when the weather cools again and I am feeling refreshed too. Gardening is a process. Even great gardens don't start out great. They take time and lots of reshuffling, the kind of thing we're all out there doing from early spring through right about now. Gardening is a process. I repeat this new mantra now as I find myself with time to take a walk or watch the birds, or dare I say it, with time to simply look at what I have accomplished. And that's a good thought. And now we fall into what we need to do in July and August with the topic Fall Vegetable Garden. In July and even August, after the longest day has passed, I make sowings in my northern garden of crops that will come to harvest in fall. Though summer is coming on strong, I am thinking about fall too. Here's where the math of gardens to maturity listed on the seed packets need a bit of adjusting, though. Since those estimates are based on spring sowings, when temperatures and hours and intensity of light are strengthening, not declining. What to do to adjust for what is often referred to as the fall factor? Counting back from the first expected frost day to fall and adding 2 weeks, some say closer to three, to the time that the crop will be expected to reach maturity. Remember that with some crops, the days to maturity are calculated from the moment seed is sown, while with others is from transplant time, so you have to figure in the time it takes to produce a seedling too. It's hard to get it exact, so I err on the side of starting earlier, but not so early that I subject these generally cool season plants to too much summer heat. And that's it for this podcast, but we've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we will continue with the fall vegetable garden and reading for the North Carolina. Oh, and we hope to enjoy it. I'm sorry. I'm Annadine Silver. Forgot to tell you. Reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.